hear ye, the Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are here, our first case, 2019-693, 2019-696, the City of Athens et al. Versus Joseph A. Testa, a tax commissioner for the state of Ohio. For the appellant, Mr. Blickendorfer.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I'm Matt Blickensurfer on behalf of the City of Athens appellants. I'd like to take 21 of the 30 minutes allotted for the appellants to address the Home Rule Amendment generally and its application to House Bill 49 and House Bill 5. I'd like to reserve 2 of the 21 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Darrell Clay, representing the City of Elyria appellants, will take the remaining 9 minutes of the appellant's time. Your Honors, I begin with the principal reasons House Bill 5 and House Bill 49 are unconstitutional with respect to their municipal income tax provisions. First, these acts dictate how municipal corporations must exercise their home rule power of taxation. That the General Assembly has accomplished this by forcing municipalities to adopt a prescribed code does not matter. The General Assembly should not be permitted to do indirectly what is plainly prohibited from doing directly. Second, as to taxpayers that opt in, House Bill 49 takes over every facet of the collection and administration of municipal income taxation. Third, these acts command affirmative actions by municipalities within the realm of home rule powers. And fourth, House Bill 49 takes municipal tax revenues from municipalities without any constitutional basis. Your Honors, I'd now like to argue these propositions in much greater detail. First, we begin with the undisputed premise, Your Honors, that the General Assembly cannot restrict the home rule power of local taxation except as authorized by the Constitution. At issue in this case are the two constitutional powers of the General Assembly to temper municipal taxation, the authority to restrict municipal taxation so as to prevent abuse, found in Article 13, Section 6, and the authority to limit the power to levy taxes in Article 18, Section 13. Your Honors, these powers must have limits, or they will render the Home Rule Amendment a nullity as to local taxation. But rendering municipal taxation a nullity is the upshot of the state's absolutist position, about which the state is very clear. The state argues that the General Assembly's powers with respect to municipal taxation are so broad and limitless that the General Assembly could altogether prohibit local taxation if it so chose. This position is inconsistent with the purpose of the Home Rule Amendment, the words of the constitutional provisions at issue, and this court's case law interpreting these provisions. This court's case law establishes some key principles for interpreting the interplay between the Home Rule power of municipal taxation and the General Assembly's authority to temper that power. First, the General Assembly's authority with respect to municipal taxation should not be construed so broadly as to engulf the Home Rule power to tax. So held this court in Cincinnati Bell Telephone against Cincinnati in 1998. The court in Cincinnati Bell held that the power to limit or restrict municipal taxation and other home rule powers should be interpreted consistently with the purpose of the Home Rule Amendment, which this court described as, quote, to eliminate statutory control over municipalities by the General Assembly, unquote. Second, the power to limit or restrict does not mean the power to compel or require. That's the lesson from this court's decision in Gessler against Worthington in 2013. There, the issue was whether the General Assembly could require a city to tax a type of income that the city had chosen not to tax. And this court held the answer was no. The third principle established in this court's precedents is that the General Assembly's authority involves specific limits on the exercise of municipal taxation. In this court's decision in Panther II Transportation in 2014, the issue was a limitation on income, whether the General Assembly's limitation on income taxes assessed against motor transportation companies was valid and whether it had the General Assembly had expressly preempted municipalities from levying such taxes. In the course of affirming and upholding that restriction, this court wrote, quote, municipal governments have a plenary power to tax, but the General Assembly has authority to impose specific limits on that power. Then again, in New York Frozen Foods in 2016, this court wrote, quote, the General Assembly's exercise of authority with respect to municipal taxation strictly involves imposing limits on the power to tax, unquote. The fourth principle distilled from this court's case law is that the power to limit or restrict does not permit the General Assembly to, quote, prescribe the manner and method, unquote, of the powers of local self-government. So held this court in State X. Rel. Cronin.
Aren't those really two sides of the same coin? If you say that the General Assembly has the power to limit, can't they say, well, you can only tax in a certain way? That's another way of saying you're not allowed to tax any other way but this one.
Justice DeWine, it's a great question in that we have some constitutional provisions that are in tension with each other here clearly. On the one hand, we have the Home Rule Amendment that grants a sphere of local self-government powers to municipalities. On the other hand, we have this General Assembly power. Well,
I don't understand how those are in tension. You seem to have home rule power where the General Assembly has granted certain things to municipalities, but you also have two constitutional provisions where the General Assembly has prescribed for itself the power to limit that power. That doesn't seem to be in tension at all.
Well, I think maybe tension is the wrong word, Your Honor, but there is a balance between those provisions. There has to be. Otherwise, the power to restrict or to limit can be used to overrule and to eviscerate the constitutional power of municipalities to levy taxes. And Your Honor, the state's position is simply that the state could restrict or limit away the power of municipalities to tax altogether. We believe that's inconsistent with the text of the Constitution, which clearly grants the sphere of home rule powers. And we believe it's inconsistent with this court's precedents, which established in Cincinnati Bell most clearly that the words and the powers to restrict or to limit must be construed in a way so that they don't engulf the municipal power of taxation.
Well, I mean, if we look at cases more contemporaneous to the enactment of the Home Rule Amendment, for example, the Rettinger case, which was 1922, that seems to suggest a pretty broad power, the General Assembly, to limit the power of taxation, doesn't it?
I agree that Rettinger has some language in it, Your Honor, that is hard to reconcile with this court's later precedents about the interplay of these provisions. However, what was at issue in Rettinger was a substantive limitation on the ability of municipalities of the type that the General Assembly has without constitutional challenge or having been upheld by this court, substantive limitations on the power of municipalities to tax. In Rettinger, the specific issue was the power of a municipality, Cincinnati, to charge utility assessments far in excess of the cost of what the city was providing for water service. And the city was transferring those excess assessments to the general fund of the city. The General Assembly passed legislation imposing a substantive limit on what could be charged for utility services, and this court affirmed it. That kind of substantive limitation on the tax authority of municipalities is consistent with what the General Assembly has done, with what this court has upheld. So the issue in Rettinger, the language in Rettinger, I admit, Your Honor, is broad. The issue in Rettinger was not broad and is not remotely like what we have here, where the General Assembly has allowed the State Department of Taxation to commandeer the entire system of municipal taxation for net profit tax within the Department of Taxation. So the other thing I would say about Rettinger, Your Honor, is that it's just the broad language, which is probably dictum in that case, is not at all consistent with this court's later case law interpreting the interplay of the Home Rule Amendment and the General Assembly's power to restrict or to levy. Cincinnati Bell makes that point very clear, Your Honor, where it says interpret these provisions consistent with the purpose of the Home Rule Amendment, which was to free municipalities from statutory control of the General Assembly. It also says interpret the words restrict or limit so as not to engulf the Home Rule power to tax. The fourth principle, Your Honors, that is distilled from this court's case law and is relevant today to this challenge is that the powers to restrict or limit do not permit the General Assembly to prescribe the manner and method of the exercise of the powers of local self-government. As I mentioned, the court adopted that principle in State ex rel Cronin against Wald in 1971. And in that case, the issue was whether the General Assembly could dictate how municipalities approved debts. Now, it was debts rather than taxation, but it's highly relevant because Article 18, Section 13 addresses municipal taxation and municipal debt in the same sentence. That provision, one at issue, says laws may be passed to limit the power of municipalities to levy taxes and incur debts for local purposes. If the power to limit does not include the power to prescribe the manner and method for municipal debt, it does not include the power to prescribe the manner and method for municipal taxation either. Now, these four principles that we distill from this prior precedents.
Counselor, let me ask a question. Does it really matter the 5% fee notwithstanding that the taxes are collected by the state or by the municipality or its collecting agency if the city or the village gets 100% of that tax revenue?
Yes, it does, Justice Stewart. And there's a practical dimension to that, and then there's a constitutional dimension to that.
Okay.
I'll start with the latter because I think it's easier. The constitutional dimension is that, in our view, for the reasons we've articulated, the state simply isn't permitted to do that. It's not permitted to take over the machinery, the administration, and the enforcement.
But does it take over? Doesn't it operate simultaneously with the city and villages?
Well, it operates simultaneously to the extent that it's an opt-in system. So what happens, in effect, is some taxpayers are in the centralized state collection system. Other taxpayers remain in the municipalities system. So the legislation has made this more complex, if anything. As a constitutional dimension, Your Honor, the issue is we do not believe that the powers to restrict or limit allow the General Assembly to take over the state, to take over.
But again, has it taken over? It would seem that that argument might have more weight if the General Assembly said all municipal income taxes are to be paid to this centralized agency, and then we'll give it to the cities. But it doesn't say that.
It has taken over with respect to any taxpayers who opt in. So I acknowledge to you there is an opt-in aspect to the system, Justice Stewart. I suggest the opt-in nature of the system makes it even more constitutionally infirm than if it were mandatory in some respects, in the sense that the choice the opt-in nature delegates to individual taxpayers how the municipal income tax system will work.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I don't mean to interrupt you, Justice.
Well, I was going to say, what's your practical argument?
The practical argument, which in our view is not, neither the practical arguments supporting us or against us are particularly relevant to the Constitution analysis in our view, but as a practical matter, the legislation is detrimental to municipalities because, as you pointed out, there is the 0.5% fee for the centralized collection system. There is the possibility of a 50% indefinite impoundment of municipal net profits tax revenues if the municipalities do not provide certain information to the taxpayer, or excuse me, to the tax commissioner in the prescribed time. There's also cash flow issue where municipalities are obtaining their municipal tax revenues not anywhere near in the same amount of time that they would if they were administering the collection themselves. There is also practical impact.
So if the 0.5 or the 0.5% fee weren't there, you still say there are aspects of it that for practical reasons deprive municipalities of their tax revenue?
Yes, there are, Justice Stewart, the ways I've already mentioned, but also because the authority, all authority to decide issues about allocation among jurisdictions, about refunds, and about appeals are vested in the tax commissioner now for those taxpayers who have opted in. The municipalities have lost control over the enforcement of their own tax systems. And that not only has significance from a constitutional perspective and from a system of government perspective, that has real financial considerations and effects as well.
From our perspective, how do we reconcile what the Constitution permits the General Assembly to do and the municipalities' authority under home rule? How do we reconcile how much can and can't be done? Is there a bright line test for us to use here?
I don't think there's a bright line, and there's going to necessarily be some gray developed in a case-by-case basis, Your Honor, but I would suggest that the court can write an opinion that establishes some tests and a framework that can guide this case and future cases. And that test is as follows, or that framework is as follows. First, the verbs restrict and limit are terms of proscription in their common ordinary understanding. They suggest that the power of home rule taxation can be tempered or curtailed. These words, in their ordinary common understanding, do not suggest that the home rule power of taxation can be eliminated or prohibited. They also do not suggest that the General Assembly can mandate anything within the realm of powers of local self-government or to require the exercise of these powers in a particular way. Again, these are words of proscription rather than prescription. So, Your Honor, would suggest that the framework or the rule for this case and future cases is that these powers allow the General Assembly to curtail or temper municipal taxation, but not to eliminate, prohibit, eviscerate it, and also not to make affirmative commands about the exercise of powers of local self-government. Because the making of affirmative commands about how municipalities can exercise their home rule power is antithetical to the notion of home rule power.
So this is not particularly unique, is it? Aren't there other provisions within the revised code that the General Assembly has enacted to similarly say, for example, for the electric light taxation, that has to be administered centrally through the state? So would you also suggest that all of those provisions that are currently in place would also be unconstitutional using the framework that you've just described?
Not necessarily, Justice French. I do think what we're dealing with here today is unique in several respects. First, its scope, and second, it goes beyond what the General Assembly has done, even in the areas in which it has exercised its authority to restrict or limit before. For instance, municipalities have no seat at the table, have far less involvement, essentially none under House Bill 5 and House Bill 49 with respect to taxpayers who opt in terms of the administration, the enforcement, appeals in these issues. That is not the same as what the General Assembly had done with respect to utility provision. This provision goes beyond what the General Assembly has done before. And what the General Assembly has done before that has either been upheld by this court or not challenged, and of course the fact that some things haven't been challenged don't necessarily mean that this court would find them constitutional. But what the General Assembly has done previously, Justice French, is targeted, limited, discrete provisions that typically, not in every instance, but typically will target something about the tax rate, the tax base, a type of taxpayer. And we do not suggest that those provisions are unconstitutional, broadly speaking, because those are proscriptions. They are not affirmative commands, and they do not involve a commandeering of the entire machinery with respect to the exercise of this local home rule power.
Council, you have used your time and you're into Mr. Clay's time, if that makes a difference to you.
It does. Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor, and I will yield to Mr. Clay.
Counselor, you'll have to turn your mic. There we go.
Chief Justice O'Connor and Associate Justices, may it please the court. My name is Darrell Clay, and I represent the 28 chartered villages and cities known as the Elyria plaintiffs, and I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. Your Honors, the net profit provisions of House Bill 49 achieve state hegemony at the expense of the balanced delegation of power by the people to municipalities and the General Assembly with respect to municipal taxing power, this court described in Cincinnati Bell. Accordingly, this court must reverse the decision of the 10th District, which incorrectly concluded that Article 18, Section 13's use of the phrase to levy taxes included, and I quote, the authority to control the machinery for collecting municipal taxes, not just the imposition of such taxes. And that language appears in paragraph 46 of the 10th District opinion. In addition to the reasons Mr. Blickensdorfer has summarized, three other reasons compel this conclusion. First, plain language textual analysis of other provisions of the Ohio Constitution demonstrate repeated usage of variants of the phrase levy and collect, demonstrating the drafters appreciated the distinct meaning of these two terms. Second, the distinct meanings of levy and collect are reinforced by the interpretive tool of corpus linguistics. And third, the passing excerpt of the 1912 Constitutional Convention cited by the 10th District should not be assigned much, if any, weight in resolving the proposition of law in this case. On the plain language textual analysis, the Ohio Constitution uses variations of the phrase levy and collect in multiple places, 36 separate times the last time I counted. Nothing better demonstrates that these two terms have separate and distinct meanings. One involves the legislative branch's decision to impose, to levy a tax, and the other involves the executive branch's administration of that tax, that is, collecting it. If different meanings are to be ascribed to these terms, if different meanings are not to be assigned to these terms, then the phrase levy and collect as used in our Constitution becomes surplusage in violation of multiple statutory interpretation canons. The appellee's response to this is underwhelming at best. They assert that many of the provisions cited in our brief were adopted after the Home Rule Amendment and therefore are not probative of what levy meant in 1912. And that response fails simply because it's factually incorrect. The Elyria plaintiffs, among the provisions that we pointed to in our brief was Article 12, Section 11, relating to sinking funds for bonds. And it uses the phrase, quote, levying and collecting, specifically in relation to the concept of taxation, saying that bonds cannot be issued unless provision is made for levying and collecting annually by taxation an amount sufficient to pay interest and to provide a sinking fund for redemption at maturity. And when was this amendment adopted? 1912, as part of the same constitutional convention that adopted the Home Rule Amendment. It's never been amended. And perhaps better than anything else, that one provision illustrates the contemporaneous understanding of the drafters of the Constitution with respect to the separate terms levying and collecting. They have different meanings. We believe that this evidence demonstrates that Article 18, Section 13's use of to levy taxes means only that the General Assembly may place limits on a municipal decision to impose a tax, and not a limit on the process by which that levied tax is ultimately collected. This conclusion is reinforced by our second argument, the interpretive tool corpus linguistics. And although this court has not previously utilized that methodology, we believe it should do so in this case, because it provides the court with an empirical basis to understand how words are actually used, either in common parlance or in specialized context, depending upon the corpus selected. Our brief referenced the court to three separate corpora: the corpora of U.S. Supreme Court decisions, the corpora of contemporary American English, and the corpora of historical American English, each of which demonstrate that to levy does not mean to collect a tax. They mean two separate and distinct things. The appellee's response to this was that corpus linguistics is not a useful tool. We think otherwise. It's certainly as useful as citing dictionaries or invoking statutory interpretive canons. And it's certainly more enlightful than our last point, which is the 10th District's excessive reliance on an excerpt from the 1912 Constitutional Convention, where delegates talked about the Home Rule Amendment and Article 18, Section 13's use. And they talked about this article giving the authority to control the machinery for collecting municipal taxes, not just the imposition. And as we noted in our brief, that exchange really does not represent a sense of the delegates as a whole. Right after the last phrase cited in the 10th District's opinion, another delegate, Delegate Pettit, rose in a point of order, which we all understand in parliamentary procedure has a specific meaning. He rose to a point of order to express that those two delegates were having a side conversation amongst themselves. And so we think that the cited provision of the 1912 Constitution, if anything, it falls into the category of legislative history that this court and the U.S. Supreme Court and other courts have said courts must be careful in guarding against relying on individual statements of legislators as opposed to materials that reflect the sense of the delegation or the convention as a whole. For those reasons, as well as those outlined by Mr. Blickenstorfer, we believe the court should reverse the decision of the 10th District and would save any time for rebuttal and share with Mr. Blickenstorfer. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Mr. Flowers.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, the laws at issue here will save businesses between $800 million and $1.6 billion annually by eliminating inefficiencies in the pre-existing balkanized system for collecting municipal net profit taxes. And so the question in this case boils down to this: does the state constitution bar the state government from pursuing a statewide solution to a statewide problem caused by municipal taxation? And the answer is no. Section 6 of Article 13 and Section 13 of Article 18 both allow for such solutions. HB 5 and HB 49 are such solutions, and the court should affirm the 10th District's decision saying so. I'd like to back up and look at what precisely this bill does. My friend on the other side suggested a rule that would ban the evisceration of the municipal taxing power, or would allow proscription but not prescription. Even under that test, these laws are perfectly constitutional. So what does the law do? As Justice Stewart alluded to in one question, this is not a usurpation of municipal net profit taxes. They still decide whether to impose a tax. They can still do so, and they'll still get the money. All this does is preempt municipal net profit taxes that are not set up to be administered and collected through a centralized system. And in that way, it's supported both by precedent from this court and by the text of the Constitution, and I'll try to take those in order. Beginning with the precedent, my friends on the other side point heavily to Cincinnati Bell, cases like Panther 2, but those cases actually favor us. Those cases make very clear that the General Assembly, if it wished to, could entirely preempt the collection of net profit taxes. And I want to be clear, this bill talks only about municipal net profit taxes, not about municipal taxes generally. So in that one area, I don't think there's any dispute the General Assembly could say municipalities may not impose municipal net profit taxes. All this law does is preempt, it's a lesser move. So all it does is say you may not, those taxes are preempted unless the municipality agrees to administer them in the manner set forth by the bills here. That the ability to take that lesser step follows from the ability to take the greater step of altogether preempting municipal net profit taxes. Second, you heard some discussion that the power to limit the municipal power to levy is limited to laws that that go to the imposition of taxes rather than collection. Well, this court's cases say otherwise. Just a few terms ago in New York Frozen Foods, the court recognized that the General Assembly can mandate that municipalities accept centralized tax returns from affiliated entities. That has nothing to do with the imposition of taxes. It's about the collection of taxes. Unless they're prepared to throw all of those laws out too, those have to stand. Second, you have cases like Franklin and Redinger, which Justice DeWine asked about. Those cases establish that the General Assembly can direct, can rather limit the purposes to which a municipality may put its funds. Both said that if you tax certain public utilities, the taxes acquired have to be used in a certain way. That is, if anything, a greater intrusion on the local powers of local governments than the bills here, because it's dictating what they can do with the funds they acquire through a tax, not the imposition of a tax, what they can do once it's acquired. And finally, there are cases like Bish and Malloy, which involved laws that dictated the processes that municipalities would have to go through before imposing or assessing a tax. Malloy in particular dealt with a law that said that in order to assess a tax against certain property owners, which is much like collection, the municipality would need a two-thirds vote from the city council. So we think all of those cases establish the validity of these laws, but I know we also want to ground it in the text so we can move on to that. Let's look at what that text says. Section 6 imposes a duty on the General Assembly to restrict the municipal power of taxation so as to prevent abuse. Section 13 says that the General Assembly may limit the power of municipalities to levy taxes. Again, I think much of this case turns on whether to levy taxes, and the power in Section 6 is limited to laws governing the imposition of taxes rather than the collection and administration. And the text, when read in context, reveals that it's not. First,
Bill, could you focus just on the Article 13, Section 6 language? The tail end of that phrase says, so as to prevent the abuse of such power. Do we have to look for abuse here? Or is that simply something that should inform us about why that provision is there at all?
I have several answers to that. The first question is, even if you were to look at abuse, we could establish that here, but I want to first address the first half of your question, which is, should the court look, must it look for signs of abuse? And the answer is no. As an initial matter, the abuse clause explains why the General Assembly is given this duty to restrict municipal taxing power. But it's not a limit on the power, and it's certainly not a judicially enforceable limit. And that follows for two reasons. First, this court said so way back in Walker v. Cincinnati, that it was not a judicially enforceable provision of the Constitution. Second, even if that case didn't exist, I, for one, cannot imagine a judicially administrable test that a court could apply to determine whether you're really getting at abuse or something else. Now, my friends on the other side suggest that abuse means something like illegal conduct. That can't be what it means. The General Assembly does not need a power to restrict municipalities' ability to tax illegally. What it's there for is to stop excessive, unfair taxation. And that brings me to why abuse would be established here, even if we were required to show it. The evidence at trial, the only evidence at trial, in fact, on filing costs, was that businesses annually in Ohio spend between $800 million and $1.6 million simply filing attention of lawyers and things like that. That's just filing in the various municipalities. that require a net profit tax. This system centralizes that, vastly reduces the cost, and thus allows them to pay while still allowing the municipalities to both impose these taxes and then to get the money. So that goes, I hope that answers your question about
Council, if there's a dispute between the municipality and the taxpayer as to the amount owed, where is that dispute resolved under a under the option to when the taxpayer opts to use the state system?
Assuming they opted into the system, it would be resolved by the tax commissioner. And that also brings me to the abuse point. Part of the problem in the pre-existing system was that municipalities, imagine a business doing that had to pay taxes in 20 municipalities. They could have 20 municipalities interpreting state law differently, subjecting them to audits in all 20 instances, and apportioning the taxes so that they may owe more than 100% of their net profit taxes. By centralizing that, it's designed, the system prevents that abuse that exists in the pre-existing system. So that's a feature, not a bug. And of course, the municipalities, if they are concerned, can seek a writ of mandamus. And what's more, Commissioner Testa testified in the preliminary hearing that in close calls, they would like to solicit the views of the municipalities. This system is not designed to harm municipalities. It's designed to make Ohio a more business-friendly climate so that companies can do business here without being weighted down by these inefficiencies. Inefficiencies that cause them to send hundreds of dollars to file taxes that may have a $0 return or a 50 cent return. That's what the evidence showed when the General Assembly looked into this. I would refer your honors to the amicus brief filed by the Society of Ohio CPAs and other groups that explain the problems that came with the pre-existing system. Now, if we go back to the text and look at the way in which levy and power of taxation is used, they're not used in a vacuum. Both refer to the municipal power of taxation or the municipal power to levy taxes. Now, if you're talking about a legislature, the power to levy may well, and sort of likely does, mean the power to impose the tax, because a legislature's ability is to make the law. But when you talk about a government, like a state or a municipality, and you talk about the power to levy taxes or the power of taxation, you're naturally speaking not only about the power to impose the tax, but the power to go out and get it. The power to impose it is not worth anything if the government does not have the ability to collect. So in that context, both levy and the power of taxation, that the General Assembly has the ability to restrict and limit, naturally includes the power to collect.
Mr. Flowers, what gives the then General Assembly the authority to charge the 0.5 or the 0.5% fee?
These same provisions, and let me explain why. Again, the General Assembly has the power to limit or restrict the power over of municipal taxation or municipal power to levy taxes. And one way you would limit or restrict that is by telling the municipalities, you may impose the tax, but you have to bear some of the cost of actually collecting that tax. And so this—
But they bear the cost with their own collection.
Right, but if you're to centralize collection and the state did not have an administrative fee, the municipalities would have less disincentive to charge taxes that are not worth the collection amount because they would have no skin in the game. So this restricts their power by ensuring—
Could the state charge 50%?
Let me first, I have two answers to that. The first is I think it would be a difficult, they could completely preempt the tax, so they may be able to do so. But more fundamentally, I don't think the court should go that far in this case. It suffices in this case to say that it's a limit or a restriction on taxing power when the fee is reasonably calculated to require the municipality to bear at least some of the cost of administering the tax. And we know this fee does that because the average RITA fee that the municipalities already pay to RITA is 1.53%. So that's three times the rate the state is charging here.
But the municipality makes that choice to do that and utilize RITA. They're not given the option here. This is the state mandate.
That is absolutely correct. But the reason the state can do it is because they're limiting or restricting the power by saying you may impose the tax, but if you do so, you will pay an administrative fee that's reasonably calculated to reimburse us for the cost of doing so. It's not on the record because this was litigated before as pre-enforcement challenge, but I can verify to you in my discussions with the tax commission that the 0.5% does not even come close to covering the full cost of this. So it is just reasonably calculated to force them to bear some of the cost of administering this tax.
And where in the Constitution is that provision?
It is, again, the limit and restrict provision. We limit their power or restrict their power by saying you may impose this tax only if you agree to do so through this system. And this is a limit.
Well, but that I don't understand how that's a limit. So what a municipality could do to offset that then would be to increase their business tax rate by 0.5%, or to whatever the amount to cover that cost.
Yeah, that is correct. HB5 and HB49 do not stop them from setting the rate. And of course, they would be forced to bear this rate some cost regardless. But to answer Justice Fisher and Justice Stewart, the power is the power to restrict or to limit. Now, if there are any doubt about the scope of the municipal power of taxation or municipal power to levy taxes, and the General Assembly's a power to restrict or limit that, it was resolved just a few years after the Home Rule Amendment was ratified. In Toledo v. Cooper, which is a 1917 case, the court made clear that Section 13 was included with the Home Rule provision to leave no doubt that the General Assembly was retaining the power over taxation that it had under Section 6. In many ways, it clarifies that significant power in the General Assembly is not given up. And it makes sense that the people would do that. The American system of constitutional law and Ohio system of constitutional law is one of checks and balances. To give the General Assembly the significant powers they obtained in the Home Rule provisions, you would want to make sure there's some check on that, particularly in the context of taxation, which can have very grave statewide effects. So the General Assembly ensured that it had, or rather the people assured that the General Assembly would retain some power to check that, so as to prevent abuse, just as they had under the former system. There was some suggestion in my friend's argument that we're arguing for an absolute power, that we could completely abolish taxation. That, I will say, could present a more difficult question, because you could say that at some point the burdens on a municipality are so great that they cannot exercise any power of local self-government because they cannot obtain any money. That would be a difficult case, and I'm not prepared to answer it one way or the other here without briefing, but it's key to recognize that this is not that case. The only tax this law governs is the municipal net profit tax. The challenges here, I think, fall into three buckets. There was the sort of an overarching challenge to HB5 and HB49 that really makes no attempt to pick out which provisions are actually problematic. That's concerning because many parts of HB5 are clearly not problematic. 718.052 of the revised code allows deployed National Guardsmen to delay the filing of their municipal taxes. 718.13 prohibits municipal officials from accessing tax information for improper reasons. There's not really a challenge here, but I take my friends to be arguing that HB 5 and 49 should fall altogether, and if that's not their argument, they haven't, at least in this court, explained what they think the proper remedy should be. So there's that centralized challenge. There's also a challenge to the administrative fee, which we've addressed, and then the information sharing provision. The information sharing provision says that the state will withhold 50% of the funds until they come into compliance. My friends on the other side suggest that it's an indefinite withholding of funds. That's not true. First of all, the word withhold naturally suggests you're not going to keep the money forever, but only until they come into compliance. And second, the law itself makes clear that it will be kept until they come into compliance. That is also what the testimony in the preliminary injunction hearing showed the commission will actually do. So there isn't no indefinite withholding, and the real challenge is to the obligation to share this information with the tax commissioner. But the power to create the centralized system implies the power to get the information necessary to actually operate the system. And they can't operate the system if they don't know the municipality's tax rates, whether the taxpayer may be entitled to some credit, and so on. I want to briefly—
What is your response to the cash flow argument made by your colleagues on the other side?
I'm sorry, I missed the what argument?
The cash flow.
So I think it does disrupt cash flow relative to the system before, and that the tax commission collects it. At the end of the month, the money is given to OBM, and then by the fifth day of the month, OBM transfers it to the municipality. But when the law, now that it's in effect, municipalities can factor that timing into their cash flow decisions. So there's, you're never going to have 100% of the money at exactly the moment you've liked it. This requires some advanced planning, but they'll know who's in the system because the state has to share that information with them. So I think while it delays cash flow, it doesn't do so in a way that's likely to harm municipalities in the long run. They have not introduced any evidence that it would. And more fundamentally, even if it would, the municipality, or rather the General Assembly, has the power to do that because it can create the centralized system in the state. The courts don't, you know, examine each clause to think to decide whether it maybe could have done better. They have broad authority over this issue. I'm happy to answer questions on anything else. I know this argument's already going quite long, but if there are no further questions, I'm prepared to yield the remainder of my time, and we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the 10th District.
Thank you. All right, gentlemen, you have 2 minutes and 39 seconds. How do you want to divvy that up? You'll need, yeah.
Chief Justice O'Connor, I'll go first and try to use only about half of that and then yield the balance to Mr. Clay.
All right.
Just a few quick points, Your Honor, in response to Mr. Flowers' argument. First of all, we know from this court's precedents and from the state's arguments that certainly the state believes that the power to limit or restrict includes substantive limitations, potentially substantive limitations that eliminate certain types of taxation, or possibility was held open that elimination of municipal taxation altogether is a close call. Second, we know the state's position in this case is that it is okay for the state to take over the entire machine.
To your point about the state's argument that it includes the power to eliminate certain types of taxation, I mean, hasn't this court made that very clear that it does include that power in the Cincinnati Bell case if the General Assembly does so explicitly?
Yes, Your Honor, it certainly, and we concede that the power to restrict or limit does include at least some ability to make substantive restrictions or limitations on the municipal tax power. That, we believe, is the proper scope. So we know that's within the power. According to the state's position today and in its briefs, also within that power is the power to take over the machinery and the collection and the appeals process and the refund process and all the procedural aspects of local taxation. We also know from the state's arguments today that the state can charge a fee for the privilege of doing that on behalf of the municipalities, a fee of who knows how much percentage. So we've got substance.
We do know how much percentage they've charged here, though, right?
Correct.
And what's the difference between charging an administrative fee than if the state, for example, had said we're going to tack on an extra 0.05% to the tax?
Well, the state, in our view, Your Honor, would not be authorized to tell the municipalities to add something to.
Well, they could certainly impose their own tax. I mean, what's the functional difference between doing that?
The functional.
And they could certainly take money away from municipalities. So what's the difference between that kind of scheme and this one?
Because it's an incursion on the home rule power, Your Honor, which if the home rule power includes taxation, it must include the power to collect and retain those taxes as well. There's the localities have a sphere of home rule power that's acknowledged. I think it's undisputed. And to take money out of the use of that sphere of home rule power is an incursion by the state on that power. And we don't believe there's any constitutional authority that allows them to do that. And to conclude, Your Honor, because I see we're out of time, the state's position has no bounds as to what a restriction or limitation may be. It includes substance, it includes the procedure, and includes the ability to extract revenues from the municipalities. These provisions must have limits, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Clay, I'll give you 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two brief points. First, the deafening silence of the Solicitor General with respect to the impact of Article 12, Section 11's contemporaneous use of levy and collect is overwhelming. This court needs to look deeply at that issue and in trying to understand the meaning of levy as used in Article 18, Section 13. Second, the Solicitor General talked with you about the record evidence with respect to costs of collection of municipal income tax. He indicated the only evidence was that it costs $800 million a year. I would urge this court to carefully examine the testimony provided by RITA's Director of Operations, Robert Meeker, who cast great doubt upon the accuracy and reliability of those costs of collection calculations prepared by Deputy Commissioner Cruz. As he pointed out, among other things, it assumes that tax preparers add an additional charge for every single tax return that a municipal net profit taxpayer files. There's no evidence of that. Second of all, it ignores the existence of RITA, which represents almost one half of all municipal taxing jurisdictions. You don't have to file multiple tax returns with RITA. You file one tax return with an apportionment schedule.
Thank you.
So, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision.